So, reading from Joshua 3 to chapter 4, verse 7. Early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from Shittim and went to the Jordan, where they camped before crossing over. After 3 days, the officers went throughout the camp, giving orders to the people. When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God and the priests, who are Levites, carrying it, you are to move out from your positions and follow it. Then you will know which way to go, since you have never been this way before. But keep a distance of 1,000 yards between you and the ark. Do not go near it. Joshua told the people, "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you." Joshua said to the priests, "Take up the ark of the covenant and pass on ahead of the people." So they took it up and went ahead of them. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so they may know that I am with you, as I was with Moses." Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, "When you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river." Joshua said to the Israelites, "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. And as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and step up in a heap." So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now the Jordan is at flood stage and all during harvest. Yet as soon as the priests who carried the Ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away. At a town called Adam, in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, was completely cut off, so the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on the dry ground in the middle of the Jordan, while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, "Choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up the 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priest stood, and to carry them over with you and put them at the place where you stay tonight." So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, "Go over before the Ark of the Lord, your God, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be memorial to the people of Israel forever."
I remember seeing a bit of graffiti where somebody had scrawled on a wall with a pressure pack can, "Accept nothing, question everything." Must have been an engineer, I guess. And somewhere I could come on underneath and put, "Why?" Probably a philosophy student, I suppose. Question for you. What would it take for you to get serious about God, about being a Christian? What would need to happen for you to stop sort of playing games with God and actually get deadly serious? I guess in a way that probably only you and God know. Ask it a different way. What would God need to do for you to take God more seriously than you do? Have you ever done that sort of bargaining with God? There's something you really want God to do. So you say to God, "Well, if you give it to me, that boyfriend, that girlfriend, that passing the exams, then I'll take you seriously." Well, what's the X for you? What is it that God would need to do for you to take him seriously? Is it a miracle? Is it a big save for that exam you thought you'd fail? If you're not yet a Christian, What would God need to do for you to become a Christian? For it to turn from being just a vague possibility, I might think about it, to a reality, your life trusting the Lord Jesus. I think it's a matter of honesty to answer that question, because if you have no answer, if you're not willing to think about it, then you've really got a closed mind, haven't you? If you think your mind is open at all, then there must be an answer to that question. What would God need to do? Or to ask it more broadly, what would God need to do for all the Christians around the whole world to tremble and wonder at God, to quit playing games at being Christian, to be willing to lay down their lives for Jesus? What would it take, not just for Christians, but for everyone in the world to take God seriously, to know that he was real and powerful, including all your sceptical friends? Well, the usual answer people give is some sort of miracle. God would need to do something spectacular, huge, maybe appear in front of us so we could see him and touch him, or maybe turn my Hyundai into a Ferrari or my Tajay into a Marni. He'd need to do something like that. Then we'd take it seriously. Well, these two chapters in Joshua that Andrew has read the first one and a half of are about a miracle. Well, interestingly, the Bible doesn't tend to use the word miracle. Miracle is a very slippery term. Try to define it, it's very hard to define. It uses words like a wonder, a sign, an amazing event. And we're told in chapter 4, verse 24, that the purpose of this sign was that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful. Everyone in the whole world to know that Yahweh, the God of Israel, is real and powerful, and so that you, the Israelites, might always fear the Lord your God. Those who were there and saw it, but also the next generation and the next generation. Well, what would it take to achieve that? What would it need to be? I presume something extraordinary. And what we find is something extraordinary. As we read these two chapters, the people actually involved in it only gradually become aware of what's going to happen, how it's going to play out. The people of Israel are on the east side of the Jordan River, looking across the river to the bulk of the promised land. And in chapter 1 last week, we saw that God says to them, "My promise stands. This land that I promised to give you, I'm going to give it to you." But that land is inhabited by people already. And between them and the land is the Jordan River. How will they get across? It's not until verse 13 that we get a bit of an answer to that question, where Joshua tells the people, "As soon as the priests who carried the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set their foot in the Jordan," that is, on the edge of the river, "its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. Then you'll be able to cross." Now, that's a bit hard to imagine, isn't it? Imagine standing beside a river. It's flowing in front of you. Suddenly, it stops flowing and you can walk across. And then in verse 15, he tells us a little bit more that helps us actually picture it. Now, the Jordan is in flood stage all during the harvest. This is springtime. The Jordan River is normally not that big a river, actually. It looks a bit like this. In fact, that is the Jordan River, or a photo of it, at least. But in harvest time, springtime, all the winter rains flood down it, and all the melting snows up on Mount Hermon and the mountains surrounding the Sea of Galilee, all that melts, and it becomes a raging torrent. Literally, it says, it overflows all its banks, all of harvest. You can see the first bank there. The Jordan has three banks, and all of those banks are overflowed. This is a raging torrent. It's more than 100 metres across. It flows at something like 15 kilometres an hour. That's much faster than you can walk. It might be easy for two spies to get across this, but hundreds and thousands of people with their children and old grandparents, with their livestock and their provisions, their tents, that's impossible. They can't get across this river. Picking it up in verse 15, "As soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at Arm, about 20 kilometres upstream. And the water flowing down at the Sea of Arba, it all stopped, was completely cut off, and so the river emptied. And they could walk across on dry ground." And then if you pick up the end of the story in chapter 4, verse 17, "Joshua commanded the priests, 'Come up out of the Jordan.'" All the people had already crossed at this stage. "The priests came up out of the Jordan on the other side, carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. No sooner had they set their feet on the dry ground Then the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and ran at flood stage as before. This is actually extraordinary. Now, if you'd been there just watching, your jaw would have been on the ground, I suspect. This can't be psychosomatic. There's hundreds of thousands of people who were there who saw it. Now, a lot of people are sceptical about the miracles in the Bible, and I don't... they think that these sort of things just never happen and they don't really happen. And some scepticism, I think, is built on something solid. That is, they recognise that these sort of miracles, these sort of wonders, are not happening in the world around us today. They're not, are they? I checked the West Australian this morning. If something like this had happened in Perth, in fact, anywhere in the world last night, it would have been on the front page of the news. A bomb in Boston, too. But there's nothing like this happening. In those days, it would have been on every TV channel in Jericho that night, for sure. Now, the scepticism recognises that these sort of events are not normal. They are extraordinary. But is it extraordinary enough to achieve the aim that everybody in the world will know that God is real? Well, to answer that, we need to ask, why the wonder? Why did it happen? Is this just some curious event out of ancient history, like the totem poles on Easter Island? A wonder that defies easy explanation, but probably you just walk away and say, oh, don't know what to make of that. Because that would happen, wouldn't it? If you were walking along the banks of the Avon River, you know, up in 2J or something like that, and suddenly it stopped flowing, and you could walk across, what would you make of it? I presume you'd probably shrug your shoulders and say, that was weird, and go and have your ice cream. Let's look at the context, though. What is the book of Joshua about? Well, the book of Joshua is about God keeping his promises, the promises he'd made to Abraham about 600 years before, that he would bless Abraham, making him a great nation through offspring, establishing a relationship with him and the nation that came from him, and giving them the promised land, and eventually, through Abram and those people, blessing all the peoples of the world, a promise that he's fulfilled in Jesus. It's happening here today. People are being blessed with the blessing that God promised. But at the time of Joshua, the issue is the land. And we saw last week God says, yes, now is the time I'm going to give you the land. So why this wonder? Because God is keeping his promise. If a river stands between the people of Israel and the land that God has promised to give them, then God will stop the river. And the Ark of the Covenant would have clearly indicated that to the people of Israel. Now, I don't know what you think of the Ark, what you know about it. If you've watched Indiana Jones and those movies, just try and put that out of your mind, because the only thing you got right about the Ark is that it's lost. The Ark of the Covenant was a box that God commanded the people of Israel to build. It was had some gold filigree on the top and these angelic figures covering the top of it. But it was called the Ark of the Covenant. That name is significant. A covenant is what? It's a treaty. It's a contract. It's promises. It is the ark of the promises of God. Inside it was a sample of the manna and those stone slabs that the Ten Commandments were chiselled into. And the Ten Commandments start by saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, who rescued you from slavery. I am your God because of what I've done for you. And when the people saw the prominent role of the Ark of the Covenant, it went in front of them, carried by the priests. As soon as the priest carrying it, their feet touched the water stopped. They go down and stand in the middle of the riverbed while all the people cross over. When everyone's crossed over, they go out the other side. As soon as their feet leave the riverbed, it starts flowing again. And every Israelite would have known exactly what that means. What stopped the river? The promise of God stopped the river. That's what it was. It's not a magic box. Not some sort of box that's got mystical powers. It's a sign, a symbol of the promises of God. The promise of God stopped the river. But there's also the boulders. In chapter 4, verses 1 to 7, we're told that Joshua chose 12 men, one from each tribe. And as they walked across the riverbed, they were to pick up some of the river boulders from the bottom of the bed. And you probably know, I hope you know, that those sort of river boulders are a different shape to ones that have never been in a riverbed. And they carried them out of the riverbed to where they camped that night at Gilgal, about 8 kilometres away. They must have been burly guys, sports science students, I guess. And then they built a monument to the event, They piled them up on top of each other at Gilgal. And in verse 21 of chapter 4, this is what Joshua said to the Israelites. In the future, when your descendants ask their parents, what do these stones mean? Like, imagine dad and his son, they go camping in Gilgal National Park. And they come across this pile of river rocks. And the son says, Dad, what are these doing here? I mean, they don't look like they belong. They're all piled up. What are they here for? Well, this is the answer that Dad is to give. The Lord, tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan what he'd done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we'd crossed. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God. What are they doing here? They're a monument to that event. See, this isn't an endlessly repeatable event. God stopping the Jordan River every couple of weeks. This is an event, this is a wonder that is to stand as a testimony for generations to come. See, when Israel starts to doubt, is God real? Is he powerful? Is he actually committed to us? I haven't seen anything happen for 100 years now. What were they to do? Go down beside the Jordan and say, come on, God, stop the Jordan again? No, they'll go down and find the pile of rocks and remember that it did happen. Those rocks were once in the riverbed. They're now here. This was a wonder. And the effects of the wonder then are quite strong and clear. Verse 24 of chapter 4, all might know of Yahweh's power. That is, the people of Jericho and everyone else to know that this is God at work, the God of heaven and earth, the only real and true God. If they were shaking their sandals before this, they're now falling to pieces, I guess, in Jericho. Secondly, for Israel to always fear Yahweh. Not just the generation that saw it must have stunned them, but the next generation and the next generation. God thinks this wonder is sufficient, not just for those who saw it, but also for those who will hear about it, like us today. Not to be repeated, but remembered. In chapter 3, verse 10, is to assure Israel that God will give them the land, as he promised. See, a river stood in the way of them getting the land, and what did God do? He stopped the river. Do you think if anything else stands in the way of Israel getting the land, God won't stop that as well? Of course he will. He will keep his promise. He'll complete his purpose. See, God doesn't say to Israel, come on, I make you a promise, just believe me. Look, watch my mouth, see my lips, just believe me. No, he says, see, I've taken you across the river. Now believe me. You can be sure. And it also validates Joshua's leadership. This wonder validates him as the leader, the one through whom God is fulfilling his promises. The biblical wonders that we find in the Bible actually have this revelatory character. They show us what God is doing in his world. It's God bringing about his plans and purposes here through Joshua. And it clearly says to the people of Israel, so get in with Joshua. He's the one I'm with. He's the one I'm working through. So is this wonder sufficient to achieve those huge effects? Or is it just some coincidence, some weird happening? See, coincidences do happen. You might know the story of Sir Edmund Godfrey, who lived in Greenbury Hill in London. He was murdered by three vagrants called Green, Berry and Hill. And you hear that and you think, man, that's weird. What a coincidence. I can hardly believe it's true, but what do you do with it? It's just weird, isn't it? This isn't simply weird. And if the Avon River just inexplicably stopped, would that be sufficient for you to know that God is real and what he's doing in the world? I presume not. You just sort of say, well, that's weird. I wonder why it happened. But this isn't like that. It's spectacular, yes, but it actually makes sense. It was predicted. God said this is how it's going to happen. And it happened exactly as he said it would happen. The timing was brilliant, was perfect. As soon as the priest's toes touched the river, it stopped. As soon as they got out the other side, it started again. But especially, it's purposeful. It actually achieves something towards something that God has promised already. Something God has been on public record of saying, I'm going to give these people that land. If the river gets in the way, God stops it. You see, this is not a coincidence. It's not just a magic trick, a display of supernatural power, as if God thinks, oh, well, I'm a bit bored today, let's do something a bit fun, I'll just stop a river. And even if there is a natural explanation, we're told the water piled up at Adar. You think, I wonder what could have done that. In 1927, there was an earthquake in that region. A landslide stopped the Jordan River flowing completely for about 24 hours. And we're not told how it happened here. It could have been something like that. It may not have been. But even if it was, it's still very clearly the hand of God, isn't it? Is this sufficient? Well, I actually reckon it is. This is an incredible wonder. It defies explanation. But more than that, it's clearly the hand of God. But this isn't the only wonder that God has done. 1400 years after Joshua comes another Joshua. We know him by his Greek name, Jesus. But it's actually Joshua. This is what John says about him. Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which aren't recorded in this book. He only records a few of them. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. But Jesus did stuff that actually left the stopping of the river in the shade. He met a guy who was born blind. He's an adult now, 40 years old or so, and he heals him instantly. Now, I don't know much about physiology, but I know enough to know that if you're born blind, all the nerve endings outside your brain, the optic nerve, as well as all the connections in the brain that allow you to see, just don't get formed. They're not there. Physiologically, they don't exist in you. How do you see? That's a creative act that is much more than maybe a psychological unblocking. It's stunning. And people, when they saw Jesus do things like that, they walked around saying, we've never seen anything like this. Lazarus had been dead in a tomb for 4 days. Jesus hadn't been around. He'd been in the other part of the country. He got there 4 days after he died. He went to the tomb. It's a public place. And he calls out to a dead corpse, Lazarus, come out. And he comes out. And the people who are there can't believe their eyes. Like, oh, touch Lazarus. Yeah, that is Lazarus. But you die. Jesus did stuff that is just stunning. But it's not just that he did stunning stuff. Here again we see God keeping his promises. God had promised through Abraham to bless all the peoples in the world, to reverse the devastating effects of evil in our world, of sickness and even death itself, to liberate people from their captivity to sin and all its impact. And that's what Jesus is doing. His miracles are called signs. They point to who Jesus is and what he's doing. He's the bread of life, feeding thousands of people with a few small loaves. He's the light of the world, bringing the light of sight to a man born blind. He's the resurrection and the life, raising Lazarus from the dead. But not just Lazarus. He culminated in his own resurrection, where death itself was rolled back. Death rolls us up, doesn't it? And Jesus unrolls it as he rises from the dead. John records for us some of these wonders of Jesus so that we would know that God is real and powerful, so that we would know that Jesus is the one through whom God is working, and so come to believe and trust in Jesus, so we would know what God is doing in the world, bringing a final, complete resurrection and new creation to this mucked up world. See, Jesus did those things not to assure us that God would do more miracles today. John doesn't say, I've recorded these because if you want to ask God for a miracle, he'll do one for you as well. He says, I've recorded these so that you will believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing in him, have life. God is free to do more miracles, but it's not the biblical pattern or promise. And these miracles tell us what God is up to. The Apostle Paul says in Acts 17, God has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He's given proof of this to all by raising Jesus from the dead. That is, the resurrection of Jesus is proof that there will be a day of judgment. When you look around UWA, does it look like there's going to be a day of judgment? I know the exams are coming, but that's not what this means. It looks like the world will just keep going on and on forever, doesn't it? One centenary and another centenary, expect it still to be here forever. And how do you know that your death is not the end, that you just rot in the grave and pass into oblivion? How do you know that God will call us to account for how we've lived, to give our life some sort of meaning and significance? Because if you just die and that's the end, your life has no meaning, your decisions no significance. By the resurrection of Jesus, death has been broken through. You will be resurrected, and therefore you will face the assessment, the judgment of God. And thirdly, it says that what God has done is sufficient for us to know that God is real and powerful, and for us to fear God always. You'd like another miracle, would you? You'd like God to do a special one for you, a very private, personal one, so that you know he's real? You'd like God to do something to address your doubts? Yeah, I feel like that often as well. But isn't what God has done sufficient for you? I think you'd understand why Jesus said it's an evil generation that asks for a sign, that demands a sign on their terms. No, he's done it. So remember our opening questions. What needs to happen for you to really take God seriously in a way that you don't now? What would God need to do for you to believe that God will keep his promises? Keep his promises to create a new heaven and a new earth, to resurrect you. What would God need to do for you to be so confident of that, that you're not driven to get everything now? Well, it isn't that God's got to do anything, is it? Hasn't he done enough? And if he's done enough, the ball's in our court. The ball's in my court. The ball's in your court. What will you do with it?